Okay, so good evening, everybody. Welcome to Policy Exchange for tonight's event on cybersecurity. I'm Chris Yu. I run the Digital Government Unit here at Policy Exchange. Delighted to welcome all of you. This is part of a series of events under the Next Big Thing banner, which we are hosting alongside Nesta and the Oxford Martin School. So Policy Exchange, as I mentioned, we have a Digital Government Unit, which I run, which is interested in issues to do with data, technology, the public sector, the future of the internet economy, and so on. The Oxford Martin School at the University of Oxford, who are one of our partners, fund interdisciplinary research into 21st century global challenges. The school there boasts over 30 different programs and institutions, including the Oxford Martin Institute for the Future of Computing, which Sadie Creese, one of our panelists, is a director. And excitingly, the school will also provide a home for the government's Global Centre for Cybersecurity Capability Building, which was announced by William Hague on the 9th of April. And Sadie will be heading that centre, which will act as a global resource for understanding how to deliver effective cybersecurity. And the Oxford Martin School has over 300 Oxford academics involved in it. And one of the conditions of their funding is that the research must have an impact beyond academia, which is why they're so pleased to be participating in the event this evening. And Nesta, many of you will be aware of. Nesta is an independent charity focused on catalyzing innovation. They provide investments and grants and mobilize research. And Nesta don't work alone, but rely on the strength of their partnerships. And again, very pleased to be working with Nesta this evening to reach new audiences and ask new questions. So tonight's discussion is about cybersecurity and the future of the cyber domain. You don't need me to tell you that we live more and more of our lives online, that more and more of our data is in the cloud, and that this poses a range of challenges for the way we think about security. There have been many estimates of the cost of cybercrime and cyber threats. Many of these run into billions, tens of billions of pounds. You'll all be aware that last summer, the Home Office published the Draft Communications Data Bill, which covered, amongst other things, provisions for monitoring internet traffic and internet activity. And many of you will have seen from the papers this morning that over the weekend, a number of experts signed a letter to the Prime Minister describing some of the provisions in the bill as dangerous and suggesting that they must be revoked. I guess when I was thinking about this event and the discussion this evening, it struck me that there's a lot of abstract talk about the cyber threats, and we can all name a bunch of corporations and organizations that have been subject to cyber threats. One of the stories that stuck with me was a journalist called Matt Honan, who writes for Wired. Many of you will have seen this story, I'm sure. His situation was one where actually, through a combination of the different accounts that he ran online, so he was with Apple and Amazon and Google and Facebook and Twitter and so on, a sort of domino effect where hackers were able to extract information from one of those providers, in this case, the last four digits of his credit card from Amazon, use that to persuade Apple technical support to let them into his Apple email account, from where they hijacked his Google email account, from where they then remotely wiped his laptop, tablet computer, an iPhone, and email, all in the course of getting access to his Twitter account. And what really made me sort of sit up and notice this was, of course, number one, that could easily have been me and many of the people that I know. And second, all of the catastrophic damage, losing all of his email, losing all of the photographs of his newborn daughter, losing all of the content of his devices, that wasn't the intended target, right? That was collateral damage en route to hijacking his Twitter account in order to post some humorous / offensive tweets. That shocked me into setting up two-factor authentication and strengthening my passwords and so on. But I know that many people I know actually haven't taken those sorts of steps, and it does leave me wondering, this won't just be something that is a preserve of corporations and governments, but actually it will affect more and more of us in our daily lives. Okay, so what we're going to do this evening is have perspectives on cybersecurity from our three panelists, and then I will open us up for questions and debate from the floor, and we've got plenty of time to have a good, engaging discussion. Just a few words to introduce the panel this evening. So first will be Sadie Kreese. So Sadie is, as I said, Director of the Institute for the Future of Computing at the Oxford Martin School. Sadie, I think you've had a career in government and industry before moving into academia. And before joining Oxford, you were Professor and Director of e-Security at the University of Warwick. So very much looking forward to hearing your remarks. Richard Thompson will be our second speaker. Richard has just completed 33 years in government service and has extensive policy and operational experience in the security, intelligence and defence world. Most recently as Chief Constable of the Civil Nuclear Constabulary. Richard's had a range of postings overseas as well as holding senior posts in the Cabinet Office and the Home Office. And he's going to talk to us a little bit about some of the threats and framework for responding. And last but not least, Peter Joplin is joining us from IBM. So Peter is the Business Unit Executive for IBM Security Solutions. Peter has 25 years experience in the enterprise security market and has specialised in cybersecurity since 2009. So we've got a great panel this evening. I'm going to pass over to them to give some sort of opening thoughts, opening remarks. In the meantime, if you want to be thinking about difficult, tricky questions for them, then we'll move on to that afterwards. If you are tweeting this evening, then the hashtag is #nextbigthing. I think we will aim to wrap up by about 8 o'clock. Okay, so with no further ado, I will cede the floor to Sadie.
Thank you. So I've been told I have to contain how long I speak for, and those of you that know me, and a few of you do know how challenging that's going to be, but I promise I'll sit down after 7 minutes. And I should also say, for those of you that are interested in the open letter that went out to the press and the new Cyber Capacity Centre, someone else that's running it is in the room. Ian Brown, might want to raise your hand, is also somebody that signed that letter, and a specialist in internet regulation and privacy, etc. So I'm sure if there are any particularly hard questions on those topics, Ian would be happy to deal with them from the floor. I wanted to begin, actually, with a reflection on what good there is surrounding all of these massive volumes of data that we're all providing. I had the opportunity to attend Davos this year, and I can tell you that around the sides where they have all of these workshops looking at future opportunity, future challenges to the planet, whether you're looking at how you feed billions of people, food security, whether you're looking at the future of healthcare and how we're really going to support this aging population, whether you're looking at the future of transport and making sure that we actually don't burn the planet out whilst we're doing that, the list goes on. All of these visions include massive instrumentization of our planet. No matter who you talk to, they're talking about harnessing the fact that there is a massive proliferation of data-creating devices throughout our lives, whether you're wearing them, whether your car happens to be an iPhone on wheels, whether it's painted in the paint on the walls of these buildings, that's what's happening. And the numbers are staggering in terms of just the amounts of data, the amounts of transactions, and the amounts of devices that are going to be present in our environments, the entirety of our environments, by 2020 and beyond. So the challenge is immense. And if you look inside of the data that's being generated by all of these things, there's a huge social opportunity. There's a massive increase in transparency. If you look at how we're holding governments to account and organizations to account, the level of information sharing and opinion sharing that cyberspace enables is a force for good. And people are building relationships with like-minded people across the globe. They're having their eyes opened to the potential that they can live out their lives, the potential of humanity and its future. And in some sense, the challenge of cybersecurity is, of course, to protect that future for the good of all. But unfortunately, In amongst this, of course, are many people that will exploit this massive scaling up of communications to do us ill, whether that's hacking and creating lots of collateral damage in order to send some nefarious tweets from someone's account, or whether that's residing on corporate networks for a few years and extracting all sorts of intelligence so that you can get to market before that particular organisation, or whether that's extracting state secrets and the like, or even targeting kids. It's quite scary, and I'm not going to go into too much detail on the threat because I know that other panellists are going to do that. But what I would say is that in some of our work on privacy, when we talk to people on the street, they really are quite surprised if you outline to them today, in today's world, not 2020, the art of the possible, that there are computer programs that can aggregate so much data about you and they can find patterns in that data that they can predict what you're going to spend your time doing for the next week. They can simulate your pattern of life. They can work out what you're likely to go purchase. And in some cases that hit the news last year, they can tell if you're a pregnant woman and which trimester you're in, so that a particular organisation could target deals towards you. Most people on the street find that pretty scary. And in truth, most people on the street find the notion that some computer program somewhere knows them better than potentially they are knowing themselves, potentially they are conscious of, pretty scary, and that's the status today. So in terms of privacy challenges, we face many. Yes, we face a challenge in what we enable the state to be able to do in looking after society and governing society and offering protections to us as citizens and as corporations and commercial enterprises versus the interests of a particular individual. But we also have to look to balance the interests of those who would make money and take the commercial opportunity that is available to us with those of the individual. And the privacy challenges are twofold. And if you talk to someone else on the street, they will say to you, it is not acceptable to me that me and my family do not enjoy the same protections in cyberspace that I do when I'm walking down the street. It is important to me that if someone steals something of mine in cyberspace, that is seen as a crime in the same way as if they break into my home and take my television. And so when you begin to look at the way we deliver cybersecurity and protection in cyberspace, it is equally as important that we enable people to understand how they lock their front door or they lock the door to their car and they understand what needs protecting and how to go about protecting it. And I do need to sit down shortly, so I will close with this. That when I asked you to look to the future, 2020 and beyond, this world of literally billions, trillions of devices and data surrounding you, documenting everything that's going on around you, the universe, the flow of our weather systems and the like, this is a massive scale up. It requires lightning speed processing. You've all heard the term of the cloud. Well, then you need to think about the challenge of governance and protection of privacy. How do we ensure that the checks and balances we've spent thousands of years developing that put people and reason and proportionality inside these decision loops can be delivered in a hyper-connected world of lightning speed? And I will sit down and hand over to my colleague.
Thanks very much.
Absolutely, thank you. Chris asked me to try and cover quite a broad waterfront of issues. I can't promise to do it within 7 minutes, but I will try and do it within 10. And in an outline, Chris asked me to just touch on some of the aspects to cybersecurity and the cyberspace that make it different, to look very briefly at some of the threats and then potentially touch right at the end on how it is that we as individuals, but potentially more importantly as organisations, as corporates, what they might be able to do to improve their levels of cybersecurity. So again, just drawing back on my 33 years of government experience, I mean, espionage, sabotage, subversion and crime are not new. But I think when we're talking about the way in which they manifest themselves through the cyberspace, there are some very particular challenges. And I think the first one is one of scale. I think it's probably true, although I'm sure some of you will contradict me afterwards, but I think it's probably true that by and large, all of our wealth and treasure today is expressed as data. And that data is stored in a virtual space, and that increasingly people who would do us harm now have access to that space. And the second aspect of scale, I think, is that the world in which we live, the technology on which we now depend, has become increasingly complex. In fact, complex to the point that I suspect that there are very few people who actually understand how the internet and modern telecommunications actually work. And it's a world that's becoming increasingly alien to the individual, but not just the individual in their private capacity, but also to the individual who may be sitting on a board of a company trying to make some quite important corporate level decisions. It has a language that has evolved in a way that I suspect is also quite alien to most people. I mean, it includes terms such as botnet, phishing, spear phishing, whaling, farming. And these are all terms that I suspect that, from a generational perspective, remain, as I say, quite inaccessible to a lot of people. The next point I'd like to make is that the barriers to entry into this world of cyber and the cyberspace is actually very low. We now live in a world where there's a virtual arms race between the software and the hardware companies that are constantly trying to improve the levels of security to their systems on the one hand, and on the other we have the hacking community for whom actually the levels of resourcing that they need to be able to engage in this arms race are very, very low. Disproportionately low, in fact. From a law enforcement perspective, cyber also now poses some very particular and difficult challenges. I mean, for instance, there's often no geographic link at all between the criminal and the victim. It's therefore very easy now for a criminal to hide themselves away using the Tor, using the cloud, using VPN or some other proxy that actually makes attribution extremely difficult. Moreover, the multi-geographical nature and jurisdictional nature now of many of the crimes that are being committed actually poses some very significant problems to conducting an effective investigation. The investigation now goes across a number of different jurisdictions where actually, if there is any cyber law, it could potentially be different, and where the law enforcement agencies potentially have very varying and not always adequate capabilities and capacities for investigating cybercrime. Another element, for instance, is that because the criminal now can rely on so fewer resources in order to be able to engage in their criminal activity, the speed, have we just launched something? The speed, once a decision has been taken to execute the crime, is instantaneous. And so the criminal has vastly reduced their risk of actually being caught and massively increased the potential value chain of their activities. And whereas before, probably the key vulnerability that existed for the criminal was when they wanted to cash out, i.e. when they would actually want to go and collect the money that they'd acquired either through some form of theft or fraud, they started to use cash mules, which again pose a slight vulnerability, but increasingly are now engaging in trading in virtual online currencies such as Bitcoin. So what are the threats, very briefly? Well, I think, as I see them, the first one, if we can imagine an arc, would be from the hacktivists. And again, I think most of the hacktivists' activity is probably very familiar to you. The most obvious one, or the most obvious grouping, of course, would be Anonymous. They first became, I think, or they first arrived and impinged themselves on the public consciousness in about 2008, and they have claimed a number of successes. And I think perhaps the most public one that they've claimed was as a result of the activities that they conducted against Visa and MasterCard when those organizations decided not to process payments on the WikiLeaks site. But there are, of course, a number of individuals. And I think most of these individuals and most of the individuals that take or form part of the Anonymous network are probably trying to promote some form of political expression, are probably trying to promote some form of social change, and at some stage are also probably trying to prove just how clever they are at being able to defeat some of the security precautions that have been put in place. And again, I think maybe an issue for discussion later on is the disproportionate nature, potentially, of some of the sentences that are being handed out to individual hackers in a bid by government to try and dissuade further hacking activity. Let's move briefly then on to organised crime. I mean, in their recent review of the government's cybersecurity strategy, the NAO stated that the cost of cybercrime to the UK is currently estimated at somewhere between £18 and £27 billion. Well, that's quite a spread, and it's not clear to me how the NAO, in their wisdom, reached that figure. And I think it's probably true to say that the true scale and cost of cybercrime can only really be estimated as a best guess. Because in the absence of any legal requirement on companies to actually admit to any breaches of security and any loss that they may have incurred, it's actually going to be very difficult to get any hard data. And also, interestingly, I think one of London's biggest insurance companies has estimated that only 19% of the organisations in the market at the moment are actually availing themselves of cyber risk insurance. And in the meantime, there's a growing cyber criminal underworld. Exploits designed by hackers in the Moscow area will be programming away, and they will then deposit those latest exploits on the internet for sale. Botnets can then be hired by the hour and the day in which to exploit those exploits. And then, of course, any number of compromises can actually be accessed and traded through a series of internet relay chat rooms on the darknet. And again, access to those internet relay chat rooms are anonymous and by invitation, and strictly by invitation only, all of which makes it extremely difficult for the law enforcement agencies and government to monitor. Commercial espionage, again, very briefly, anecdotal evidence that I've come across would suggest that actually commercial espionage that's being engaged in by commercial companies in order to seek some form of competitive advantage is alive and well. And whereas some of the internet sort of security providers will engage in the sale of due diligence work, which usually will involve, and quite lawfully, the use and exploitation of readily available data mining tools to conduct open source investigations, there is an increasing number of perhaps less salubrious companies that are now offering for sale again commercially engineered exploits that are used expressly for the kind of activities that one would normally associate with organized crime. And then finally, I think there's that really interesting area of state-sponsored espionage and state-sponsored sabotage. Again, only recently this year, in February 2013, the US government published its National Intelligence Estimate, in which it names Russia, Israel, and France as having engaged in hacking for economic intelligence, but also at the same time makes it clear that the cyber espionage engaged in by those countries pales into insignificance when compared with China's effort. And whilst China has consistently refuted these allegations, of course, the cybersecurity company Mandiant also published in March a long report that tracked China's espionage activity since 2006 against 141 victims that included international organizations, government bodies, and private sector companies. And it linked those espionage activities very firmly to China's economic plan, which has China by 2022 a world leader in a number of technologies. And clearly, the suggestion there is that the way in which China is going to reach that world parity, if not supremacy, is essentially through its ability to steal the intellectual property of a lot of international companies. And then finally, sabotage. And again, there are some recent examples of that, of course. We've seen North Korea attack South Korea only last month. And I seem to remember that there were tens of thousands of computers in South Korea that were hacked, resulting in some catastrophic loss of service in the banking sector and in the media sector. And again, we had the examples of Stuxnet, Flame, and Shamoon, which was the denial of service for Aramco in northeastern Saudi Arabia. So finally, what can be done? Well, the government have published its cybersecurity strategy, 10 steps to reduce cyber risk. It's not a bad read, and it clearly marks an extremely important step in the determination that the government has shown to improve cybersecurity and to protect the economic well-being of this country. But from my perspective, conceptually, there are three interlocking areas of activity that are required. The first one is to design the appropriate enterprise that will protect, monitor, analyse, and respond to any attacks or incursions or disruptions from any unauthorised actions. And it's not just about relying on technology to protect your perimeter. It's also about having in place the right governance structure, the right structure that actually allows any organisation or company at the most senior level to really focus on the types of threats and dangers that exist. It's about knowing within your organisation what is business critical, what is the information that you absolutely have to protect at all costs. How does your value chain work? What are the independencies that you as a business really rely on in order for you to be successful? And what are you doing about ensuring that your value chain is as well protected as you hope to be? And then finally, I would talk about culture. Is cybersecurity really something that is embedded into the culture of your organization? Is it something that your people are imbued with? Is it something that takes place on a daily basis, well, maybe not a daily basis, but on a regular basis by way of training and education, so that the people working within your organization really understand why it's important? Now, the second element, as I see it, of this mutually supporting structure is the ability to conduct a forensic investigation should you ever realize that you suffered some form of malware attack. And again, you know, any number of patches can be put in place, any number of sophisticated technologies can be deployed, but if you have suffered some form of malware attack and you are unable to really understand the true nature of that attack, then actually the patches that you're putting in place are probably almost immediately redundant. And it's not possible to really upgrade your defensive architecture, as it were, until you've had that full understanding. And a lot of that will involve you as an organization actually being able to integrate a huge amount of data for you to enable that forensic investigation. And the third part, and then I will sit down, is the ability to scan for new and emerging threats. And it is only by having a proactive engagement in terms of your ability to scan the horizon for those threats that will enable you then to adapt and put in place the kind of improvements that will be required. And again, there is technology available these days that will enable you to look at the potential threats that might be emerging from the dark web and the dark net that will enable you then to take the corrective action. So I'll finish there. And I think I've probably tried to cover too much space and ground in a short space of time, but obviously we're happy to take questions later.
So thank you, Richard, and thank you, Sadie. So I'll try and bring some of that together. IBM looked at this probably about 5 or 6 years ago and came up with a model around Smarter Planet. And that really is around things being instrumented and connected, and then you get intelligence from that. And if you then look at that from a business perspective, as Sadie was saying, that's a good thing. But looking at it from a security perspective, it's, well, who are you? What are you trying to get to? What have you done? And if you've done something, how do I know about it? So data is all pervasive. And there are all sorts of statistics, but you know, the one that I like is that in the last 2 years we've generated more data since the dawn of civilization. And this is only growing. If you talk to any telcos, the actual rates and the bandwidth is increasing probably exponentially every 6 months. And that's because of all the devices. All the devices we've got in this room are all connected in real time. Data is moving around. So actually, how do we start to manage that? So we look at this in a number of ways, that we have research ourselves through X-Force. So we have a large team that look across the wide spectrum of different devices and ways to communicate and come up with a report. And there's a report that's out currently at the moment, which you can download. And it goes into a wide spectrum of different attack vectors, what's actually happening now, what's actually coming along, where are the critical areas that we're actually looking at. And some of the stats that actually come out of their research, that something like there's been 66,000 vulnerabilities detected since 1986, of which 54% are still unpatched. So even though these are being detected, there's no guarantee that the actual vendor will actually come up with a patch to actually mitigate against that. And as Richard is saying, these attack vectors are changing so frequently that by the time you actually get a signature to detect something within malware, then actually that signature is out of date even before you probably get it down to the device. So how do you actually look at this in a real-time environment? How do you look at virtual patching technology? So looking at the base patch management within the infrastructure, which will allow you to actually protect the network. And we talk to a wide range of organizations. I mean, IBM is synonymous with larger organizations and the enterprise, but we talk to a wide range of smaller to medium businesses, and more so now than ever, because they are having the same problems, not probably as bigger than the bigger organizations, but they're still having the same pains in terms of malware coming into the network. How do they look after patch management? How do they look at join and leave processes? How do you look at the infrastructure of application management? And the whole area of this is now moving into what we call security intelligence. So how can we start to actually understand what's happening on the network and start to be proactive about how we take action against that? And as Richard was saying, you actually need policies in place. So the organizations need good governance and good practice in place. But they then go to then from the basic criteria of having, I've got firewall, I've got content, I've got antivirus, to a more reactive state where security is underpinning all of the infrastructure as opposed to something that's being added as an afterthought. And the problem with afterthoughts is they tend to be more expensive. And then if you actually have a more sort of proactive environment, you can then start to look more intelligently at actually what's happening within the infrastructure. And that means that it's going to cost you less to actually manage what you're doing. You're going to be more proactive in terms of being able to identify those threats and actually start to take action in a more meaningful way as to what's actually going to happen within the environment and to maybe take down some services or to move things around. We've got 12 security operations centers around the world, and so we manage the assets of many thousands of organizations. We currently see over 13 billion events a day. So we have to sift through that and find out what is the meaningful stuff that we actually need to look at. What is the stuff that we actually need to take action against? So I think the whole idea of this in terms of being more proactive and being able to understand what's happening within the environment is the only way that we're going to start within the cyber environment to be able to manage this complex data set. Gone are the times where you can actually grab something, stick it in a database, and start to do something with it. You're having to move now in a real-time environment. You're having to actually interact with the data as it happens and actually capture the data sets that you want to, and then let the stuff actually move on or put it into a data warehouse, and then you can go back and actually look after historical analysis and those sorts of things. But the real-time data is where it becomes critical, because you have to take the reaction now. So hopefully that's given you a good insight, and look forward to a good discussion. Thank you very much indeed.
Okay. So thank you very much. So three fascinating perspectives on some of the cyber issues and threats and challenges ahead. And if you needed any more proof that this was real, I've been informed by Twitter that while we've been talking about this, Sepp Blatter and FIFA have had their Twitter accounts hacked. So it's really happening. Now I will open up to questions from the floor in a moment, but I don't normally abuse my position as chair, but I feel like I have to on this occasion because it is so interesting. And I just wanted to pick up on this point about privacy, I guess, that as we describe all of these mountains of data and having very high situational awareness and being able to monitor the threats in real time, it feels like we are heading into this world where an enormous quantity of data is being collected. So you mentioned the case of the retailer that can detect which trimester someone's in from the bundle of purchases. The conversation here about the comms data bill and monitoring of internet traffic and retention of records and so on. Maybe this question should come at the end rather than now, but do we have to accept the erosion of privacy in order to remain secure? Is that what it comes down to? Anyone? Deep breaths all round.
I think the challenge there is actually who, depending on where that data resides, then dictates as to what laws are actually applicable. And the challenge is that pretty much everybody have got very powerful mobile devices, that they're actually storing lots of stuff on there. So there is a school of thought that says that, okay, well, I can, to a certain extent, manage a mobile device. In terms of the data on there, I could kill it, I could do various things to it. But actually, when you then start to then dissipate that into a cloud environment, then that becomes a little bit blurred. Certainly, I think there is a school of thought that says if you're going to put it into a cloud environment, then maybe you should think of it being actually being allowed anybody access to share it. Because how do you know it's encrypted? How do you know the access control around that? How do you know if I move from a different service provider to another one, that the information that I had one service provider is completely removed and moved to another area? So I think it's a very complex problem, and I'm not sure there's a really good answer at the moment.
So my response to that would be no. We don't have to give up privacy, and more strongly than that, nor should we. And in fact, part of our responsibility as being thinking people that are alive today in this time and place, in a broader sense, is that we have this debate, and that we have this debate now before it's not too late. We have a huge responsibility to protect privacy for many, many reasons, not least because we have seen the force for good that these communications can have in parts of the world where, frankly, governments at large and organisations policing those societies are not doing right by their nations. But bring it home to the UK today, it really, really does matter. And if you imagine a future, there's something very unique about this data. It's persistent.
Yeah.
So it used to be that you could be at university, you could go out and have a wild party, and people would forget about that. You'd move on, you'd get a career, have children, and that was something that was accepted as part of your life when you were a teenager or early 20s. Nowadays, that data is tagged and it's out there. And I can tell you now, I challenge any of you to go and try and remove yourselves from cyberspace. Good luck with that, because most of us signed up to terms and conditions and gave blanket consent when we did so. And most of us will not be able to recall all of the different places where we have done that and shared our data. And so it's exceptionally important that we actually mature this debate. And you know what? I think it's an opportunity for better security. Because we of course, people will do us wrong. Of course we need an ability to modernise our protection mechanisms and to collect that kind of information and take them to task on it. But we have to do it in a balanced way. And if we all became so much more able to manage our data and our lives in cyberspace, and so much more able to take responsibility, then we would all collaboratively raise the value of that data, whether it was in providing better healthcare or whether it was in providing better fights against terrorists. If we all are engaged and have something to protect and look after and take responsibility for, together we'll raise the value. That's my belief. And in part of that means we have to take a stance to protect our privacy. We can't just say no, we don't care, because it's worth nothing.
Richard, anything you'd like to add?
Well, I'm going to sit firmly on the fence on this one. I think what I would say is that the debate is an extremely important one, and it needs to be had. And I what I would say in response to one or two of Sadie's points is that I don't think that the vast majority of people actually understand the extent to which they've lost control of their data anyway. And that's not an excuse to say that actually the state should have a role in capturing that data, storing that data, and then having access to that data as and when the requirement may arise.
And I don't really know, I mean, I don't have a personal view on exactly where the line needs to be drawn. But what I would say is that I also think it's increasingly difficult for the citizen as an individual to actually protect that data in their own right. And yes, whilst there, you know, I would agree wholeheartedly that as part of an individual's social responsibility, they should do everything they possibly can to make that data secure. I think with what's going on these days, it is almost impossible for the individual citizen to do that. Where the line should be drawn, I couldn't tell you. I think the fact that we're having the debate in this country in a way that I don't see that debate occurring elsewhere, I think is a very healthy sign. I think it's a sign of actually of a vibrant and healthy society. But I wouldn't like to predict exactly what's going to happen for communication. But,
okay, I'm going to open this up for questions. So we've got a roving mic. Why don't we take them in pairs so that we can work through them? So the two gentlemen at the front. And if you could tell us your name and organisation before your question, that would be great.
My name is David Webster. I'm from an organisation called the Indus Group. My question is about the balance of threat between state and non-state actors and issues of plausible deniability. My understanding is it's fairly easy for a state to essentially disable the critical infrastructure of another state, and therefore there is an element of, to use an older term, mutual assured destruction that comes into that and deterrence. But the ability of a state to outsource those kinds of attacks to other entities really tends to undermine that. So I wonder what kind of faith, if any, you put in state-to-state attempts to regulate cyber warfare and cyber security.
Okay, so hold that thought and we'll take the gentleman behind you as well.
Manish Chaneja, MJ Analytics. I've got a question regarding the recent presentation that was given by the CTO for the CIA at the GIGA-UN conference in March, in which he sums up by saying it is really very nearly within our grasp to be able to compute on all human-generated information. So my question for the panel is, given that we may be discussing what policies and governance procedures we can put in place in our country, in our organisation, in our personally, would that be overridden by the fact that these guys over in the CIA are saying we're going to actually own all of the data in the world in terms of being able to access it and process it any time?
Okay, so two non-trivial questions to get started. One about the balance of states and non-state actors, and we were having a conversation earlier about what if it's entirely non-state entities operating in this space. And is the whole conversation moot if the CIA can compute over all data in the world in a short space of time anyway? Who'd like to go first?
Well, I'm happy to start that first. What I would say about the connection between the state and the private sector when it comes to, I think what you're saying is that could the state subcontract the private sector to engage in hacking activity? And the answer to that is, generically, yes, of course. Would it be lawful? I suspect that that would depend on the country in question. So I think it would be a significant test of the law in this country if the government decided to subcontract offensive cyber operations to the private sector. And I would actually hazard a guess that it was unlawful, because none of the existing legislation, I think, would provide for that. If you turn it on its head, the premise that we work under is that our systems are vulnerable, which is why we've got to have resilience in place, and that therefore, even if we were to suffer some form of a catastrophic attack, the consequence of that catastrophic attack would be mitigated by having sufficient resilience in place. And from my limited understanding of the way in which some of these computer network attacks are designed, you get one shot. So you write your code, you fire it off, and you hope it works. Now, if it doesn't, then that's it, it's game over. And if it does work, then the other side basically put in place the mitigating strategies that they have available to them in the hope that they can then come up with an alternative way of making sure that whatever bit of critical national infrastructure it is that's potentially been affected can be sustained. And you know, you then step straight into a whole world of the extent to which, you know, we, for instance, would want to engage in that kind of activity. And you know, there's as far as I'm concerned, there's no debate about the requirement to be able to do that as a matter of course. I think, you know, the ability to respond to some form of hostile computer network attack is there. It's clear that the government develops that kind of capability, but I'm not sure that our government would ever want to engage in that activity unless hostilities had effectively been established. Now, there is a really interesting question that has yet to be debated about the extent to which this whole sort of area of cyber warfare can be regulated in the same way that ultimately we were able to design international protocols and treaties that govern the use of nuclear weapons. And I think that that must be something that will be developed in the not-too-distant future. I think it's still just a little bit too early as people just grapple with the true extent of what it is that we're talking about. But it must be in the international community's best interest to have some kind of regulated framework which actually establishes some ground rules that everyone can sign up to. Just going to very quickly to the second question, which is about the CIA being able to capture the world's data, I would say good luck to them. I'm not quite sure what it is that they would do with all of that data, because again, I mean, you can still have some extremely sophisticated computing power that would enable you to try and sift your way through all of it, and then what? I suspect that theoretically it's possible, but from a practical perspective, what would you do with all of that data?
Okay. Anything to add?
I'm looking at it in a slightly different way, because I mentioned the X-Force report. It clearly states that one of the big emerging factors from last year, or the latter half of last year, was kits being available to buy. So that's really taken the entry level down from the attack vectors from probably organised and state to anybody effectively can go and buy very powerful technology to do some quite damaging things for relatively low amounts of money. So if you get a number of people of a similar vein wanting to do something, then that's going to have the same effect probably as some sort of state sponsored, but it has completely different motivations as to why they're doing that. And I think that's a more worrying factor because, as Richard was saying, there's pretty much no regulation, it's the Wild West. So as governments try to legislate or try to look at cyber as weaponization technology, on the other hand, the actual Wild West is going off and doing its own thing. So courses may actually move in a different direction. And as Richard says, in terms of the data, by the time you've actually collected all of that data, it's out of date anyway. So the goodness is actually being able to look at stuff in real time.
Let's take another couple of questions. So the gentleman at the back has hand up.
Thank you. Tony Gilman from the Institute of Ideas. I want to go back to some of the points that Sadie and Richard were making about the value of this debate. And it's really, one value is it educates people. We think more about cyber security and this sort of thing, and that's great. But another question for me is about the culture that we inhabit and what's deemed as culturally acceptable and politically acceptable. Because in reality, from what you're saying, it seems to be fairly straightforward. You know, you cannot stop a lot of stuff. It's going to happen. And whether that's government or whether it's industry or whether it's hackers or whatever, quite a lot of things can happen. The question then becomes is, it seems to be the best form of protection is what we as a society and as mature people regard as being culturally and politically acceptable. And it doesn't seem that we've had enough of that debate in our society so that we can draw a line under no. If you do that, you really are an organisation or an individual that nobody wants anything to do with. So my question really is about how can we raise our game, if you like, about getting people to think about drawing their own judgments and making those public and having, I don't think it's all about codes of conduct, but it's about some sort of public recognition of what is and isn't acceptable as opposed to what is and isn't technically possible.
Okay. Thank you. And the gentleman at the front row, did you have a question?
Oh,
yeah, microphone's on its way.
Hello.
Can you use the mic if it's on?
Harrison Talbot Brown. I just had a quick question. Panel have touched on, but not really gone into detail about cyberspace as a vector, as a effects through cyberspace rather than effects in cyberspace. If I put a sort of terrorism slant at, and then throw the London Underground, and think about what destructive activity people may be able to complete in the future. I just wondered for the panel's views on that and the relative levels of threat that against data theft, espionage, etc.
Okay, thank you. Well, should we start with a question about how we sort of manage what's culturally acceptable, Sadie?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think it's really interesting. And speaking as somebody who's a cybersecurity person, I think that we, as cybersecurity people, of course, are very varied. Remember that we're techies, but we're not just techies, crime fighters, business people. But I think we're very guilty of talking in jargon, and I apologise, I've probably done it today. If I think you're right, in truth, this is about a massive cultural change experiment. It's about how do we change it for everybody so that everybody feels enabled and engaged. And in truth, that means probably the language that I use is not going to resonate with people. And so we do need to do something about making this topic much more accessible. And I would say that it's, we all stand up and use data as a good example, but it's cyberspace. It's a space. It's a space where people live and they conduct their lives and they do stuff and it affects their emotions. And it's as much about protecting their PIN numbers and their access credentials, but it's also about ensuring that they are happy. They feel it's a space that they can engage and do business or take advice on healthcare and vote. And all of these things that we want and need people to be able to do in cyberspace. And so I think we're still stuck in this world of information and data and technology, and it's not surprising that most people are turned off by that, think they're not meant to understand it, and they'll leave it to the people that know what they're doing, who in truth aren't deploying things that are that effective.
Why isn't it enough to rely on individuals and self-interest in this space, right? Like if I choose a whole bunch of weak passwords or not to protect my iPhone, then the consequences for me could be pretty catastrophic, right? But I can know that.
It's a pitch for the complete free market and to see whether it will deliver the cybersecurity balance that we need.
Well, some people advance an argument that actually, so we're in this period of flux, but the market for privacy protecting innovations hasn't happened yet, but maybe we're on the cusp of it. And mm-hmm. Or is that bunk?
It's interesting. Personally, and I have to speak personally here, I don't think that all of the areas in which we were led to believe that free market and competition would deliver better and enhanced and cheaper services have delivered if we look back over the things we've privatised over the last however many years since I was in school. In truth, that's not to say that perhaps there was something wrong in the way we've gone about privatising it, or perhaps some of these things were fundamentally not really meant to be.
Yeah.
When I studied at school, I can remember one of my textbooks saying, here's some examples of industries that can't be privatised. And without naming any, I can tell you many of them we did go ahead and privatise after I finished that particular part of my syllabus at school. I don't know that that's the case, actually, that you could leave this to the free market. I wonder if, at least in this time, we have a social responsibility to each other, to the corporations, to the UK and to the global society, to think about how we go about doing these things outside of just let the market determine it.
Okay.
I think the issue that you raise on culture is an absolutely fascinating one. I think And I hope that there will be, you know, a really interesting debate on this. And I hope that actually the people that will lead this debate potentially will be, you know, school children. Because a lot of our laws relate to the protection of property. And you know, it's about protecting our property, it's about protecting the right to property, it's about protecting ownership. And yet somehow, when it comes to the virtual world of cyber and the internet, those rules don't seem to apply. So a lot of teenagers, I'm exaggerating, I'm drawing anecdotal evidence from my own family. Teenagers seem to find it quite amusing to go online and to mess with each other's Facebooks. Now, a strict interpretation of that would be they're interfering with each other's property in a way which potentially could actually cause them to be in breach of the Computer Misuse Act. Now, am I suggesting that we should go out and enforce that? Absolutely not. But I wonder to what extent those new rules that are actually going to enable us to create some kind of understanding about where the divisions of what is acceptable and isn't acceptable actually need to be developed, potentially by, as I say, you know, the youngest generation that we've got. Because the point that Sadie was making earlier on about the fact that, you know, if you've got an embarrassing photograph now on your Facebook site, it's there forever. And the consequences of that have yet to make themselves felt, I think. And it's a debate that needs to be had, it's a debate that needs to develop. And it's only those people who will be most affected by the consequences of that who I think will potentially be the people that want to start establishing some ground rules and actually having some parameters about what is and what is not acceptable. Because I think this is an area where actually it would be almost impossible for government to legislate and then enforce, just because of the scale of what's going on and the scale of the breaches that might then occur. It's just something that I don't think government can even begin to try and regulate.
I agree with Richard from a personal perspective. I mean, I was actually saying the same thing about property. I mean, there's no legislation that says you've got to lock your front door of your house. There's no legislation that says you've got to lock your windows. There's no legislation that says you've got to actually lock your car. Okay, your insurance may be null and void, but that's slightly different. The point being that you do that automatically because it's your data, it's your property, it's your asset, and you have an obligation because you've earned it and you've bought that to actually take due care about what you do with it. And the same must be about your data as well.
Although I was just going to say that, so we don't have some of those regulations, but we do have building codes and standards around blocks, and we have rules that say if you're going to drive a car, you've got to wear a seatbelt. So,
but there's no rules.
But maybe just, yes, and scale, if we were just looking at regulation as our tool, would be hugely challenging and policing. But remember, not everybody thinks about their own private property first and foremost. There are still parts of the UK where people don't lock their doors, yeah, and that they feel part of their street. Mm-hmm. And they might protect their street, and they might have a very good idea of who lives on that street, and they might between them know very quickly when someone new is on that street and when all the doors should be locked. But it's not true to say that I think we're in agreement in the sense that we all have a concept of that house and that door. It just relates to different parts of society differently. There are parts of society where they share the phone still, or they share the house PC. Not everybody has their own mobile in every part of our demographic, and that's just one country. And that's not necessarily to do with things like poverty. It's to do with the fact that people live differently to each other, and they relate differently to each other. But yes, I mean, if you were just looking at policing regulation, clearly the scale is enormous. And actually, it's not just scale, it's speed. And how would you put yourself in the middle of that? How would you do your checks? How would you ensure that this is the right data to go and collect, and this is proportional, and you have good reason to go and investigate further. And that's actually, to bring it back to the observation of the CIA being able to process every piece of human-generated data on the planet, etc., I think the things that we need to concern ourselves with were there, and not necessarily whether it's the CIA or not. It's about this scale issue and about how you put controls into that space. Because everybody has said in a different way today that those controls are likely to be vastly different to the kinds of controls that we have been living with and in humanity up until now. And that's why this debate is so important, because they do actually need creating
in terms
and thinking about.
The other question just now was about some of the other threats in this space and the connection to terrorism and threats playing out in the cyber domain as opposed to the cyber domain being a vector. Do you have anything to offer on that?
Well, I'm not quite sure what lies behind your question.
Shall I very quickly rephrase?
Yeah.
So we speak a lot about data then. You can also use cyberspace as a vector in order to have a physical effect of some description or another. So for example, by attacking the London Underground signal network, I can disrupt, degrade,
All the Stuxnet.
It's kind of your Stuxnet space.
Yeah.
But you know that was done. Well, obviously it wasn't Stuxnet sponsored, but if you put like a terrorism or organised crime aspect and loads of behind that, what kind of threat that was? That's really a plausible question.
I'm not sure that this is the best forum in which to start talking about national security issues, but I mean, I think it's probably safe to admit that there is obviously a degree of concern within government that terrorists will start to adopt some of the same techniques that have been used by organised crime, but adapting them for a different effect. And yes, there is that concern. I mean, yes, part of the government's agenda with the communications bill is to give it what it perceives to be a better chance of being able to capture some of the data that it feels it will need to be able to prevent those forms of terrorist activity from taking place in the future, or at least if the terrorist activity does take place, will then give it a much better starting point from which to be able to start the investigation. But that then takes us straight back to one of the first debates that we had, one of the first questions that we addressed, which was that tension that exists between the state's need to be able to have that data, have access to that data, be able to store that data, if not indefinitely, then certainly for quite a long time, and at the same time, the individual's right to privacy, which would then, for the individual to be able to say, I've never committed a crime in my life, I have no intention of committing a crime in my life, and therefore I don't want you to be able to have access to my data. So I think that was perhaps a long-winded answer to say, yes, there is obviously concern. There have been indications in the past. Al-Qaeda, for instance, has looked to being able to exploit the internet and cyberspace more generally to be able to A, conduct its terrorist planning activity, and B, actually to use that vector, as you called it, as an end in itself.
Okay. Let's take another couple of questions. So, Jonathan, maybe you're in the second row, just held up for a while.
Thank you. I'm David Wood from London Futurist. To what extent might there be a technological fix to some of the problems you're describing, namely personal bio-authentication? A lot of the problems you've discussed are when somehow people can find out your password by one means or another, or other personal data, and then use it. But if all the systems involved fingerprint detection or voice print detection or some other system like this, would it be much harder? Would that therefore alleviate some of the worries? Or perhaps instead might it just be the next step in an arms race in which there is no easy solution.
Thank you. And over this side, so the gentleman in the blue sweater.
Yeah, I agree with what Sadie said. Kerry Zitz, I'm an investor in security businesses. I agree with what Sadie said earlier, that it's a force for good, openness, and somehow I do believe in the checks and balances of Western democracies. Where I have got some issues, I'm not sure whether Richard is still serving or not.
No, I'm resigning.
Okay. Is that there's almost no penalty for criminal activity. So we currently have 43, you'll correct me, police forces, most of whom are absolutely no fraud officers, a huge backlog of cases to do with forensics. So if you had carte blanche, how would you improve this current situation?
Okay, so Well, let's mull over the question about penalties and cyber, and then the previous question was about, is there a technological fix to this? And I would observe that, of course, fingers can be cut off and so on and so forth. But does technology...
I think the short answer is no. No, there isn't. In my view, technology can help us, but all of the things that have been discussed here tonight are not associated with needing stronger passwords. And there are many routes into a system other than faking someone's credentials, not least persuading somebody to use valid credentials to do wrong on your behalf. And actually, if we do move to such hard biometrics and behavioural metrics, the cost of recovery, because it never works 100% of the time, so of resetting that and establishing who's the valid owner, it sounds simple, but it won't be. And if you talk to anyone who's had their identity stolen and what unraveled in their lives as they try to recover that situation. So there's a time and a place for all of these different pieces of technology, of course, but no, there's no single piece of technology that will solve these problems. It will require diplomacy, rules of law in the international sense, right the way down to small pieces of technology, and including delivery of technology that doesn't have so much vulnerability in it that can be exploited as well as another routine.
Yeah, from a technological point of view, I think that's a very important fact in terms of getting consistency across multiple different platforms that you're actually connecting to. So that's just from a hardware but a software perspective as well. So inconsistency in security enforcement is one way that people can get in, as Sadie was saying. The application of actually having multiple different ways that you can authenticate, again, is a more positive way because you can decide which way you want to authenticate. And then you need to mix that in then to risk management. So you'll build the profiles to how people are activating and going about their everyday business. And if that starts to deviate, then that's when you need to start to take action because it's something that's abnormal. And that's the way that you're going to be able to work because I would like to and do have different ways to authenticate. And that gives me a lot of flexibility in terms of how I can do things. But security is at the back end of that as well. So that's where you need the consistency of security enforcement and that sort of security middleware layer that arbitrates between the user and the activity, and based on what they're doing, there's a risk profile, the level of access that they need, maybe a stronger way of accessing it. And so it's dependent on that, as opposed to saying, you must use a biometric, you must use face recognition, whatever, because there are ways around that, they might not be inconvenient, those sorts of things.
So I met somebody recently, it's a fascinating story, who got really frustrated with the fraud detection algorithms that were trying to profile her behaviour. She was fed up with being phoned up and saying, we're blocking your card, where are you in the world? So much so that she goes out of her way every week to do something fairly random on the internet. That might be searching on diseases that have nothing to do with her, or shopping for things that she doesn't really want. Because she's trying to fool the profiling. She doesn't want to be predictable. This is not a security person. This is just something that this happened to.
Yeah.
And she's just fed up with this future of being profiled. So and the warnings and the systems.
Yeah.
And so there is a potential backlash against that, which is, are we going to make it so hard for people to be different and change and creative? Are we just going to reinforce similar and consistently similar behaviour over their lifetimes because it's just so hard to interact with our society and cyberspace if they ever do anything new or different?
That's nice. Yeah.
The best security is security you don't know about.
Right.
Could you elaborate on that slightly?
People will find, whatever you put in front of somebody, if they don't like it, they will find a way of going around it. That's life, that's human nature. If you can have security that is absolutely woven into the fabric of what they're doing, and it is not as invasive as something like biometrics or something like that, or ear recognition or eye recognition.
Or something they want to do.
And that's where we need to get to this compromise in terms of the different levels of authentication and authorization based on what you want to use and how you want to do it, but then marry that back into a level of, well, if I'm doing something quite sensitive, then I want something quite strong to actually do that. And that may be a different profile from where you work, when you're at home, when you're out and about. So the systems will know that you're out and about in an open Wi-Fi, therefore we'll do a different way of authenticating. If you're at home and you're using the same PC you normally do, and you've got the same attributes that you normally do, then there may be a lower level of authentication. So that's really where we're getting to, but the back-end systems need to have consistency of security enforcement, and that's the problem. When you get inconsistencies, you get problems, and that's where people can leverage those and subvert systems. So no matter how good the locks are at the front, if the windows are slightly open, somebody can come in through the window.
Richard, we have another question about penalties and the rules of regime.
Well, the penalties do exist, of course. I mean, the penalties for crime, for theft, I mean, they're well established. Do the law enforcement agencies have a big task on their hands when it comes to tackling cyber-related crime? And the answer to that, of course, is yes. What is the government strategy? Well, the government strategy, in essence, falls, I suppose, into three parts. First part is to encourage the private sector as much as it possibly can to improve its levels of protective security to minimise the chances of that crime happening in the first place. The second strand to its strategy is to, in a world of budgetary constraint, to create centres of excellence, and ultimately the main centre of excellence, as it were, that will lead the fight against cyber-related crime will be the National Crime Agency, which will then draw under it the existing resources that the Serious and Organised Crime Agency and the City of London Police have, for instance. And they will take, while already taking a national responsibility to investigate as best they can, the more serious elements of cyber fraud and crime that are being committed. Is it going to be perfect? Of course not. It can't possibly be perfect because of some of the complexity and the scale of the issues that we've already touched on. And then the third element is to encourage and help generate an international network of cyber-related forensic investigative skill. So that's a bit of a mouthful. What does it mean? What it means, for instance, sharing best practice, investing a bit of money along with our partners in organisations such as Europol and Interpol that will develop the kind of European and international network that will help facilitate some of these really complex investigations, which, as I alluded to before, can take you outside of the UK almost immediately. As you start to pull on the thread and you discover that actually this botnet that was responsible for conducting this particular fraud has relied on computers all around the world. And by having this kind of infrastructure and this support network, as it were, it will then facilitate these types of investigation. Does that mean that we can safely predict that in the next 5 years there's going to be a vast increase in the number of successful prosecutions and convictions? Don't know. Is the honest answer to that. And again, I think we're talking about a really complex landscape. I mean, what would be nice would be to be able to get enough to be able to start making it, start by having a deterrent effect and by making it clear that this kind of crime cannot be conducted with impunity and that there will be consequences. And things like asset seizing as well as asset tracking will come into it. But again, that will then require this kind of international legal framework that isn't really in place yet.
Okay, so we've got lots.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's probably not really an answer, but it's the best I can do.
I'd like to see a more aggressive stance that we are behind the criminal, and whether there was an interesting piece in the Evening Standard today, how they've named some criminals who are serving time, and these guys are happy to serve the time because when they come out, they'll still be there, pot of 20 or 30 million.
Of course.
And whether we shouldn't be more aggressive in collecting that money and then just sharing it between a few nations, perhaps.
But then you're going to have the necessary protocols in place.
Yeah.
Where all of that's then possible. Yeah. And they just don't exist.
I'm going to take some more questions. I've seen loads of hands up, so we'll take three and then one. So down in the front row first.
Thank you. Paul Thompson. I'd like to understand what the implications of government's ability to see inside encrypted connections. So this is talking about the data comms bill. The foundation of e-commerce, no one's really touched on them yet. So what would it mean? You're effectively giving a porous organisation access to the uber set of citizens' data. What would that mean for the digital economy?
Okay, great question. So I'm going to take two more. So a lady by the door.
Hello, Emma Carby with The Watch. It ties into the earlier question about culture, but do you think there's a certain level of corporate responsibility that needs to be tied into cybersecurity? So the amount of information that companies are asking us to put into the cyber world that isn't really needed, in terms of the work that I do, we've seen that a lot with things like Google and the privacy policy changes from last year. So I just wanted to know what your thoughts were on that area.
Okay, thank you. Let's take one more. Gentleman in the green shirt.
I wanted to ask about the academic research that's going on in the UK at the moment and ask, really, have we got the balance right in academic research between the research that's perhaps directed or perhaps funded by with government policies and strategies in mind, and on the other hand, research that is completely wide open and is left to academics to imagine all sorts of possibilities, etc. There's always that tension in academia.
Thank you. And I didn't catch where you were from, sorry.
Sorry, I'm Adam Smith from Research for Learning Magazine.
Okay, thank you. So, so three questions there. One about what are the implications if the government can see inside encrypted communications? What the debate around corporate responsibility in this space and what companies are asking us to put into the cyber domain? And the scope and direction of academic research. So if you could keep your answers concise so we can take one more round of questions after these. Who'd like to go first?
Shall
Sadie?
I take the last one?
Okay, go for it.
Speaking to my heart here, I do feel it's been fantastic in my space, which is cybersecurity research, the level of investment that's gone on in recent couple of years. But I do feel that it's, as somebody who has ideas, that there's no space at the moment for radical ideas, because it's also well structured and signposted, and it's this or that, and we're looking for this or that. And I think you really have, there's a necessity to bring in, from a philosophical point of view, stuff that challenges the paradigm. And unfortunately, I don't think, and it's probably not just cybersecurity, but in general, we do enough, but it's hard to see how one does, because if one holds those budgets, and you have to have some kind of governance process about how you assign who gets to benefit and conduct the research, those processes inevitably involve reputation, are these ideas credible, well, to be credible, they've probably been thought of before, or there's been some run-up. So I don't know what the solution is, but I think you're absolutely right. There is no space for really, really radical thoughts unless you're prepared to do it on your own and require no funding support. And that's the truth of that situation.
Okay.
And interestingly, I think there's the beginnings of a debate within government on action on whether we should aim to replicate the two funds that exist in the US. The CIA and the DOD and the US each have a fund that enable them to invest and help encourage investment in new technologies. And that these technologies need to have ultimately a dual application. So an application that is specific to the intelligence and defense world, but actually has a broader application, which can then be used for the sort of the general benefit and the public good, as it were. And, you know, I don't know how you feel about that, Sylvia, there are always strings attached, of course, to the government, and, you know, government lies at the back of it. But, I mean, I would have thought, actually, this could be quite a positive development, not least because if you look at some of the really successful technologies that have come out of Palo Alto and Silicon Valley in the last five, well, actually, I think Qtel, which is the CIA investment mechanism has only existed since 1999, but certainly since then, some of the really interesting technologies that have emerged, which we take for granted on a daily basis now, have at the heart of them investment from CIA and subsequently DOD.
I think we need a permission to fail. We need some kind of portfolio management-y thing where you're allowed to spend 1-5% of this big investment on stuff that's just really bizarre and seemingly may have very little chance of success, but on balance over a period of time, you need one of those to succeed to change the world in which we live.
Just to move us on to some of the other questions there around the corporate angle of this. So, what's the answer to companies pushing us to put more and more of our personal data into the cyber domain? And what's the answer to if e-commerce relies on crypto traffic and we are contemplating allowing the state to look inside that? Does that blow the whole thing apart?
Well, on the first part of your question, and I think it's a matter of personal choice, isn't it? And you know, I personally have absolutely no sort of social profile at all, because I find it from a personal perspective.
Somebody will be out there now.
Completely, you can check as much as you like, and you know, I don't have a Facebook site. My Google profile is very, very low, et cetera, et cetera. And that's just from personal choice. And I think it is a matter of personal choice. And it'll be interesting to see, actually, whether some companies start to offer a service that doesn't require you to put in so much of your, so many of your personal details, when you just know that there's then going to be a risk that you're going to be on some internet mailing order. And you're just getting bombarded with adverts for a whole lot of stuff that you just don't want. Whether actually people are going to reject that, and actually that market forces may actually then start to prevail in the sense that those companies that just want or offer a very straightforward transaction that require you to share as little as possible of your personal details will then become more successful. And I would hope that actually the answer could be through market forces on that particular issue.
Yes, and much more dynamic notions of consent. It's so brittle at the moment. People need to be able to change their mind. They need to be able to stipulate conditions. You know, you can have my data. In fact, you can have even more of my data, but not if you're going to go and do business in this part of the world, or not if you're going to treat your employees this way, or etc. At the moment, it's just blanket, brittle. You get it, you don't get it. If you want to go do that, you have to hand all that over. There has been pressure on the social networking environment, so they've upgraded their privacy controls, but almost every other market hasn't got any kind of upgraded controls. We need dynamic understandings of our relationships with all of these different organisations, governments included. What I would say about your point is that one would hope, as this debate unfolds, that it would include things like let's not throw away all of the checks and balances we've developed over thousands of years that would require you to have very good reason to look inside my encrypted communications wherever they may lie. So I might understand that you need a very fast muse to do that if you have good reason, but that doesn't mean that you no longer have to have good reason, right?
Okay. We are coming up against time, so what I will do is if someone has got an absolutely killer question they think hasn't been answered, then I'll take that, and then I'll give the panel a chance to respond to that and anything else you want to add in conclusion. So, have we got one volunteer for the current question? We do.
Carl Allen. The phrase Wild West, is it loosely used, or did somebody make a study and said, in order to respond to this, we have to treat it in the same way and look at the history of events in the Wild West? So, for instance, in the Wild West, citizens played a very large part in enforcing the law. They went about half. So is it a studied phrase or is it just colourful phrase?
No, it's more of a colourful phrase, but trying to get over the fact that there is little regulation, and you're right, you know, it may well be that the citizens actually provide that regulation.
Okay. Well, look, we are almost out of time.
We've got a moment for concluding comments or parting thoughts if you'd like to offer them. So.
From an IBM perspective, we spend many millions of dollars every year on research. We've got 9 security research centres around the world, and we're looking at all of the cutting edge areas around hardware, software, technology. We've recently done the homomorphic encryption, where you can actually search on encrypted data without actually being able to decrypt it. So we are pretty much at the cutting edge of security, over 2,000 patents last year. So there is lots of things that we have on the wagon that hopefully we'll be able to productize and bring to market as well.
Okay, thank you, Richard.
Only to say that I've very much enjoyed this evening, so thank you, Policy Exchange. But I think the one thought that I would leave in your minds this evening, and I don't think we've actually sort of touched on it really, is what should we be teaching in ICT in schools? You know, what are the issues that we should actually be teaching children today, right from the get-go, as it were, about their responsibility when it comes to using the technology that is now available to them?
Thank you, and Sadie.
Yes, so thank you. This has been great fun and very stimulating. And I think, being an academic, I should probably set some homework, and it's this. That you can come and get engaged, and I know it's an engaging topic, but picking up on this observation that we need to do better for the sake of society, perhaps when you all go away, and maybe tomorrow or the next day, could you just ask yourselves over breakfast or lunch, why doesn't this feel relevant to me anymore? And then let me know if you have any insight, because it's that we need to address. It's not engaging you in this room. That we seem to be able to achieve. It's keeping the engagement so that everybody feels engaged. So if in 24 hours or 48 hours you remember this piece of homework, you can find me. Unfortunately, I'm out there. Very easy to find my email address. And let me know how we could make sure that you were thinking about it over breakfast.
Okay, so you've got your assignment, and that is it from us. If you'd like to join us for the final Next Big Thing event, then it's on the 14th of May. We'll be discussing urban mobility, so driverless cars, carpooling, future cities, and all that sort of stuff, which promises to be tremendously interesting. But for now, please join me in thanking the panel.